It's good to be here, and I notice on the board about ageing. At my age, it's good to be anywhere. For the past week or so, I've been uncertain of what to do this morning, mainly because what I'd prepared was really taken into the shade by the events in Paris last week. I knew there was conversation after what I was going to say, and I could talk about the crisis in our society, but I had the feeling that irrespective of that, we'd probably end up on Paris, so why not deal with that too? And then I ended up with 3/4 of an hour, and I thought that was a little bit long. So what I decided to do was to have the manuscripts of both, which you can take home and look at in your leisure. And what I hope to do is to simply outline both of those today. And let me say from the outset that I don't expect you to agree with me. I'm not asking you to agree with me this morning. You may differ from what I say, and that's okay. All I want to do is to share with you how I see the situation. Let me give you a précis of what I'm asserting about our culture being in crisis. Firstly, that our modern society emerged from and is a product of the Christian West. Now, Bonhoeffer and Bultmann all made this quite clear in the middle of the last century, that we have emerged out of a Christian context. Secondly, that our culture has cut itself off from its roots, and just as plants wither and die when they're cut off from their roots, so do cultures when they forget their past. Now, I'm not for a moment suggesting a return to the Christian faith as we knew it in the past. Much of that belongs in a museum. What I'm asserting is that to jettison the Christian faith completely is to cut ourselves off from our spiritual and cultural roots, and that the death of our culture is an inevitable consequence. Thirdly, that our culture is in crisis. We've reached the crisis point, the critical moment which leads either to life or death. I'm using the word crisis in the medical sense of reaching that point where it's a case of life or death. And the evidence for this is overwhelming. And I literally could speak for hours on the way our culture is collapsing. Then fourthly, the catalyst for life, for positive change, is what I refer to as awareness, known in the Christian faith as contemplative prayer. Now, at this point, I'd ask you to hold judgment as to the meaning of the word prayer. It's very, very different from trying to change God's mind or asking God for something. The historian Yuval Harari points out that the era of history we are entering is not only one of technological transformation, but it's also going to make a fundamental transformation as far as human consciousness and identity are concerned. And he points out that the really big question of our day and generation is, what do we want to become? And this is the question which dwarfs all our current economic, political, and philosophical debates. Now, I think he's right, except that I think the question, what do we want to become, dates back a lot further than our day. Indeed, I would say that it was the agenda of Jesus of Nazareth. And as I said, I could start now and go for 3 hours on the crises we face today, and many of them are up there. Violence, domestic violence and drug dependence is rapidly increasing, as is the number of children under care, astronomically. The last figure I heard, I think it was 45,000 in Western Australia. It's increasing so rapidly that Judge John Pascoe of the Family Court comments, "We feel like there is a tsunami. The number of cases in this court where there are allegations of violence, mental illness, drug and alcohol abuse have increased exponentially." That's the judge talking. In addition to this, the promise of the computer age is collapsing around our eyes. The amount of junk and advertising on the net is now enormous. And I must admit that I laughed aloud the other day when I read that the Russians and the Chinese have hacked into our plans for the new submarine, and from now on, sensitive information will be hand delivered. Have you ever heard anything so ridiculous? A device that had so much promise in terms of providing information and education has now become something to be feared, as are the drones which are circling above the world today. The same goes for social media. Great promise and a piddling performance. But nowhere, and I was interested in it came up there too, is the cultural crisis better seen than in our financial system, which collapsed 8 or so years ago and is about to collapse again. In Australia today, the average personal debt as a percentage of income, in other words, the amount that we've borrowed, is now the highest in the world. What a record. The highest in the world. We really are debt men walking, while the rest of the world is getting into little boats and escaping crippling poverty. We are living miles beyond our means. Greed, unfortunately, is still good. Now, what should we try and do about these crises in our culture? Well, first of all, we must not try and reinstate Christendom. Christendom is the exercise of power by the church. Christendom is dead, and all the Queen's horses and all the Queen's men will not put Christendom together again. The past has passed, and it's futile and unwise to try and reinstate it. It's a different playing field on which we play today. What then do we do? I think Keith Rowe is the one who states it so clearly and succinctly when he says, "We must rethink Christian belief in the light of insights and understandings not available to people of the earlier generations." We must rethink Christian belief in the light of insights and understanding not available to the people of the first century. How do we do this? Well, I'm almost embarrassed at the simplicity of my suggestion. The answer to the question, what to do about the crisis of our culture, is, wait for it, to pray. And before you laugh me out of court, let me explain what I mean by prayer and my belief that more things are wrought by prayer than this world dreams of. By prayer, I do not mean asking God for something or expecting God to do something. That to me is a parody of prayer. I do not see God in terms of an extraterrestrial, all-powerful ruler whose mind can be changed through prayer. But I do see prayer as central to life, and until we learn to pray, we will continue to mess up and our society will spiral down into chaos and destruction. The prayer I'm talking about is contemplative prayer, where we still both the tongue and the mind and we simply let God impact upon us. It is not irrational, It is more than rational. And that is why so many people find it difficult, because we live in a rational society. I think, therefore I am, is how Descartes put it. No, I love, therefore I am. Prayer isn't a matter of achieving or earning or receiving. It's about seeing, and from that seeing, everything else proceeds. If the culture of fear, self-centeredness, and producing and consuming are the only games we play, then they become our reality. And what we seek to do in prayer is to break free from that reality and become aware of a deeper reality. Albert Einstein put it very well. No problem can be solved by the consciousness that caused it. Prayer is the cleansing of the lens of perception so that we can see things more clearly. And what I'm saying is that contemplative prayer is the only way out of the crises we face today. Now let's look at the Paris massacre. And the question here is why? On the 13th of November, did 8 men in Paris go on a shooting spree that killed over 100 people? And the answer that we are being given is that they were radicalised. And I would suggest that this is arrant nonsense and contrary to all the evidence. They were religiously motivated. When they opened fire, they shouted out, "God be praised." And at the appropriate moment, they killed themselves in the belief that martyrdom leads to heavenly bliss. They offered their lives for the establishment of the caliphate on earth as it is in heaven. And this was the root cause of the massacre. It was, is, as they say, bleeding obvious. And it's also the elephant in the room, which both politicians and people refuse to recognise. And even when it is recognised, there's no understanding of what to do about it. Problem solving depends on accurately defining the problem. And with few exceptions, this is not being done today with respect to massacres. Massacres like we've just experienced in Paris. The terrorists were deeply religious people. What we saw in Paris was a group of religious people obsessed by a fundamentalist approach to their scriptures and determined to die and receive the heavenly reward. They saw themselves as ordained to carry out the instructions of God as revealed by Muhammad in the Quran. And herein lies the essential problem. And what was the reaction of the massacre? The papers were full of it. Page after page, the reporters laid out the details of the massacre. The details, without going into the cause of it, except for one journo in The Australian, Paul Kelly, the oldest and the wisest. And Paul said, "It is absurd to suggest that the violence on display has nothing to do with religion. It is conducted in the name of religion. Its appeal springs from its religious base, and the solution will require a religious element." Very profound words, in fact, so profound that I wrote to him the other day and sent him my little dit and said how much I agreed with him. Now, in the light of his words, let me now look at the religious situation that I believe is crucial to the understanding of the situation and its amelioration. In essence, it is what I refer to as the fundamentalist problem. The adherence to inerrant, outdated, and reactionary scriptures, be they Islamic, Christian, or any other. Here lies the problem. Scriptures which say, "Let the high praise of God be on their lips, and a two-edged sword in their hands to wreak vengeance on the heathen. And in Paris, they carried out this scriptural command. They shouted, "Allahu Akbar, God be praised." And they killed and wreaked vengeance on the heathen. Now, incidentally, the scripture I just quoted was not from the Quran, but the Bible, the second last psalm, to be precise. And I used it to show that this is not solely a Muslim problem. It is a Christian problem as well. It is the problem of a fundamentalist approach to scriptures. Let me say it as clearly as I can. The Paris massacre was the result of a group of religious people adhering to literal fundamentalist view of their 7th century scriptures. They saw themselves as ordained to carry out the instructions of God as revealed to Muhammad and to receive their heavenly reward as martyrs. The fundamentalist approach to scriptures is the basic problem, and it is the elephant in the room of which no one will speak. Why? Because there are millions of people throughout the world who have a fundamentalist approach for their scriptures. You may have seen the dispute between Carson and Trump about the Republican nomination. And it was said then that 25% of the US and 50% of the Republican electorate are fundamentalists. Any wonder then that the elephant in the room remains unacknowledged and continues to tramp through the world, wreaking havoc wherever it goes? Now, I like to think of myself as deeply religious. In fact, I've even been involved in a massacre. Not as a part of it, but trying to prevent it. And I can tell you that the shock and awe bombing in Baghdad was shocking and it was awful. And it was a massacre. Not one Australian soldier was killed, but thousands of women and children were. The Iraqis had no air force, no navy, and no weapons of mass destruction. It was a massacre. What then is required of those of us who are deeply religious? For whether we like it or not, we are a part of the problem. Firstly, we desperately need to rethink the faith in the light of understanding and information not available to the people of previous centuries. To believe that the world was created in 7 days and that there is a personal God in the heavens controlling the levers is frankly absurd. Secondly, we need to see God as the spirit of life, the energy of the universe, the creative energy of love in which we live and move and have our being, the ground of our being, not a being. And thirdly, the scriptures are the record of faith, and they reflect the understanding of the time in which they were written. And that's all I want to say this morning. The end of what I want to say, and I would hope the end of the fundamentalist approach to scriptures that I believe is causing such devastation in the world today. Thank you for being so attentive. I hope that we can discuss it.
Thanks.
Whereabouts do you want me, Ross?
So, as Neville said, he would like to have a conversation about this, and he recognised that we may have different positions on some of the issues raised.
Sorry.
You want some attention, Paul? You've got it. Thanks for fixing up the microphone. That's lovely. Feel free to make comments. Yes, John.
I asked Neville
a question.
Questions, comments, reflections.
Could you just talk a little bit more about God? You mentioned the notion of the world being created in 7 days and there being a personal God who controls the levers. And then you talked about that in fact God is the spirit of our being. Could you just talk a little bit more about how you see who God is?
Yes. The point I was making, and I continue to make, that the descriptions of God that we've got within the scriptures were those as understood by the people of those days. And they and everyone else thought of God in terms of a person who had levers and controlled what was happening to the world. They thought of God as a person, as a father. Now, in those days, that was perfectly logical, and it was as correct as they knew. Now, we today know that there is no heaven. We don't believe in a flat earth to start with. We don't believe there's hell down below to which one goes and heaven above to which one ascends. Perfectly valid concepts in those days, but not today. We know it's a totally different thing. God, to me, is the loving energy driving the world, calling it to fullness of life. The greatest text in the scriptures to me is John 10:10. I have come that you might have fullness of life. And this is the whole thing of life proceeding forward. The energy of life is God calling us to fullness of life. That opening song that you had was superb. It was on this same kind of theme. And Jesus is the, and I use the word deliberately, the embodiment of that fullness of life which the energy of life is calling us. In other words, Paul Tillich in the days 1950s was saying that God isn't a being, God is the ground of our being. The ground of our being, the life energy, the energy of life that is within each one of us, calling us to fullness of life. So I suppose what I'm saying is that the understanding of God as it is within so much of the church and within the scriptures is of a day and a generation that doesn't have the understanding that we have today. I mean, to me, creation has never been in the past. Creation is in the future. And God is calling us into that creation. So that's about the best I can do, is that we are a being, a race, the human race, in process of formation, and God lies at the basis of that. God is the energy that the powering force of that. I don't know whether that helps, or other people can come in and just differ with us on it. Yeah. Yeah. Well, he's entitled to his opinion too, and that's not mad. Except that our idea of good can vary so much from person to person. I think what the Christian faith is on about is, that's very good. Somehow Jesus got left out of it. Now, what I go back and say is in terms of what Yuval Harari, I mentioned him, he's the historian in Africa who has a history seminar on the web of 69,000. That's not bad going. He's the one who says that the big question is, what do we want to become? What do we want to become today? Do we want to become computerized beings with no sense of emotion or love? You can't get emotion in a computer as yet. But that's driving me off. Yeah.
Just quickly, I suppose one of the things you're talking about is the issue of fundamentalism and the literal reading of text. How do you propose that that can be dealt with people that need certainty? So when I'm dealing with a five-year-old child, they need certainty. And quite often, or often, you have people without the mental faculties that grow beyond that need of certainty. Or people that are brought up in cultural backgrounds whereby they're not taught about the possibility of uncertainty. They are, their culture is, there is certainty, there is truth, and this is it. How would you anticipate that resolving this issue of fundamentalism and the need of certainty can be resolved in those sorts of situations?
And I mean, you've pointed up what I referred to as the elephant in the room. You know, it's a huge problem that we face. But what we have to recognise is that if we take that approach, we are engendering the types of things that happened last week. That they were people who were following out the directions of their scriptures. And those directions are in our scriptures. And the problem is, as I said, millions of people, literally millions of people. And what we're doing at the moment, we're talking about radicalising, we're talking about everything else. They were deeply religious people and they were on the wrong track. And what we have to do is to change the direction before it is too late. Because if we rely on fundamentalist scriptures, then go out and play with your poisonous snakes. Go out and kill on the basis of that psalm, which is just line for line what was happening in Paris. That is the consequence of the approach that you're talking about, which I think is almost the easy approach to life. It gives certainty. You don't have to use your mind. It gives everything like that, but it also gives massacres like we had last week. I've got no answer to your question. Yeah.
I was just reflecting on you talking about our understanding of the physical world has changed so much over the millennia. And at the same time, I was just thinking about how human beings haven't changed.
Yeah.
And that, like, the first time Jesus got up to speak officially, they started trying to kill him from that moment, sort of thing. And that we've got plenty of wood stashed away to build more crosses. And that Jesus is on his way at Advent, and we're going to like him as a baby, but we're going to want to put him up on a cross as soon as he challenges what we value, which is stuff that he's really going to challenge. And that's just going to keep going. That's what I'm feeling.
And the essential situation has not changed, as you say. There still is a man, and the reading set for today is when he was pulled. This is relevant too. He was pulled before the courts, and Pilate was interviewing him, and Jesus in our scriptures says, "My kingdom is not of this world." And people have latched onto this, say, yes, it's the heaven, the world in the future that we're all going to. And it's a translation which is shocking and which is now being corrected. What Jesus is saying, my kingdom is not on the basis of this world. And he goes on to say, if it were, my disciples would be fighting. Now, it's got nothing to do with some heavenly kingdom out there. This is the only world that we have. And what Jesus is saying is when that Pilate's world is a very different world to the one that he's talking about. But this kind of dialogue which he had with Pilate was very revealing. You are a king then, says Pilate, thoroughly confused, didn't have a clue as to what was going on. And Jesus said, thou sayest it. You're saying I'm a king. I'm not saying I'm a king like you're thinking about. A king I may be. The kingdom of heaven is what I'm on about. A phrase which in those days meant very different to what it is accepted within the fundamentalist group today.
Hi, I've taken Paul's turn with the talking stick. This is not a flippant comment. I really am wondering if this is true, that this is a period of history that we will live through, just as humans in the past have endured centuries of other things that have been awful. Is it that these people will grow over the centuries to be more enlightened, and we just happen to be living in that part of history where we would like to set the goal that everyone was enlightened and everything was peaceful, but maybe it's not going to be? Is it possible that that's what we're looking at?
I didn't quite hear. The mic's not very good.
Okay. I'm just
and
saying,
also, I went to the hearing specialist the other day, and they've recommended I get hearing aids. Just the last bit. I mean, I got the idea of the way that it may be that we're going through a period of not recognising it all.
Well, just as in human history, some things have taken centuries to change, yet we live in an era where things change very fast,
yes,
and we might
yes.
expect that. But it could be that we simply will be living through a period of history that will take centuries to change, and that is the current human condition. Or do you think there's something that could speed people up from thinking things from 7th century into some of the good of the 20th century?
Yeah. The.
Or do we just, this is it, this is our life, this is our world, and we live through this period of time of danger and fear and peril?
Well, it would be nice if we did have the time to slowly work through this. But unfortunately, I mean, the way things are developing at the moment, with robots and things of this nature, and the way that computerisation is going at the present moment, it is frightening as to what is just around the corner in 30 years' time, when, I don't know whether you saw in the paper this week, a new company's been formed with a robotised bricklayer who can lay bricks 100% better than and faster than any human being. This is just the first little bit where it's moving so fast that we haven't got the luxury of having time to work through it. The top research officer at Google, I've forgotten his name, but he's longing for the day, and he's working for it, when he can download his whole mind and personality into the computer. And he reckons, give me 10 years, and that will be a reality. Now, I share with you the delight or the wonder of being able to work things out slowly, but that's not happening. Nor is there any evidence in the past. I mean, Darwin lived a long time ago, but there are still people who reject everything that he said and did, and still believe in a world completed in 7 days. Now, it's not only a case of working things through; it's not accepting reality as it really is and living in fairyland, and that is a recipe for disaster.
Just one more comment or question or thought just, from Grace, thanks.
Just a quick one, thank you very much. It all seems pretty tricky to me. There seems to be a rock and a hard place problem here. We've sort of got the fundamentalist approach on one hand that's not good, but we've got the way modern life is now that's very lacking in contemplation. So if we recognise that life is you know, the people who perhaps have rejected religion and are living very fast, consumer-driven lives, how how do we step into the gap with the contemplative solution where we're saying, yes, there is God, and there is another way besides being like this, when those people perhaps have rejected fundamentalism but have thrown out the baby with the bathwater?
And that really, to me, is the central issue. You ask the average young adult today who isn't involved in the church, and their answer is, I don't believe all that stuff. It's the stuff I don't believe in too. So we're both on exactly on the same path. And there's the I'd like to spend more time on the prayer aspect of it. That very quickly, it's like looking at a painting. You can look at a painting and you can talk about it. This is vocal prayer. What a magnificent painting, everything like that. You can look at it and you can think about it. Isn't it magnificent the way that they've done this? And you can that's meditative prayer. Or you can look at the painting and allow it to impact upon you. And that kind of relationship, that kind of thought generates an awareness is the nature of contemplation. It's becoming aware. Seeing the situation as it really is. As I mentioned, cleansing the lens of perception. All of those kind of things are, to me, the direction and the way in which we must go at the present moment. And that's why, for example, I had to write to Paul. And to say that he was on the right track when he said, this is about religion and it's up to those who are also deeply religious to make our contribution, which is not going to be made by anyone else except us.